Joining us now, a guy whose voice is on our open because he just inexplicably praised my prowess, Karl Rove. Hey, Karl Rove, welcome back.
Praised your prowess.
Yes.
My goodness, you were alliteration day.
Well, it did work. Am I right?
Exactly.
Kind of stumbled into it.
Did.
You can follow him at Karl Rove. He's got a very popular Twitter guy. First off, Karl, how do you characterize the Republicans' play in the House yesterday?
Well, embarrassing and let's see how it plays out today. If they get a vote today and they pass it, then yesterday will be a footnote. It will have caused them to make minor tweaks in the measure. They've added $30 million in some border spending requested by some members. They've tweaked the language in the provision that treats OTMs other than Mexicans the same as we treat Mexicans and Canadians, allowing us to remove them from the country quicker and without an adjudication hearing. It was embarrassing, of course, and it also hid the embarrassment that Democrats ought to feel that in a chamber that they run with the dictatorial command of Harry Reid, that they can't bring up a measure because he's decided that he is the only person who knows what they ought to vote on, so no amendments are allowed. I mean, that was really an extraordinary performance yesterday.
Yeah, so he didn't allow any amendments, so therefore he did not get Joe Manchin, and he did not get Mary Landrieu, and he got all the other Democrats, no Republicans. Here's Senator John McCain. He just has had it. Cut 7.
Now we have a humanitarian crisis on our border, a humanitarian crisis of incredible proportion. And what have we presented here in the United States Senate? I say shame on you. I say shame on you.
And he just goes off, and he's so frustrated because he's not allowed to do his job.
Yeah, and look, for over 200 years, we've had the House of Representatives, which has more tightly controlled rules. It's a large body, so the rules have tended to limit the amount of amendments that can be offered, that it puts more of an emphasis on the efforts of the subcommittee and the committee to arrive at a proposal and delay it before the House, and then for a reasonable number of amendments to be considered. The Senate has been a much different body. It has been, sort of a 100 equals, where particularly since the rights of states are represented by these two senators per state, they have tended to say, okay, we're going to allow a wider range of amendments to be offered, a looser rule regarding the discussions and debate that takes place on the floor. We're going to require a supermajority to limit debate. What the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, has decided is that 200 years of operating doesn't matter. What matters is his control, so he is now using an obscure rule to do a thing called filling the tree, which means he literally limits how many amendments can be offered, and it is left up to him to decide who and what amendments get offered.
So it's ridiculous. And you know what? That gives people, Republicans, an opportunity to say, listen, yeah, I'm running to win my individual state, but I'm also running to get rid of Harry Reid because as a leader, he's a failure. As a stooge for the Democrats, he stands out above the rest. I can't get over his statements that everybody knows Mitt Romney doesn't pay taxes. Talk about the Koch brothers. This guy's running a political campaign from the Senate floor. It's an embarrassment.
Well, look, we've always had partisanship in the Senate. The question is the degree to which we have it. Today, it's completely partisan. We've also had people make outrageous statements, but Harry Reid makes them on a routine basis. I remember once receiving a phone call when I was in the West Wing. He called and he said, "Now, Karl, I just made a speech in which I called the President George Bush a liar and a loser. I didn't mean to call him a loser. Would you tell him I apologize? I didn't read the speech in advance. He just put it in front of me, and he called him a liar and a loser, and I didn't mean to call him." I said, "Wait a minute. Senator, his schedule's free. Why don't we just pump you into the Oval Office and you can tell him, oh, I got to go." Bam, bam, hangs up. You know, that's the kind of guy this guy is, and he's only gotten worse with age. He's just out there.
He's up in 2016. He's got to go.
Well, you saw the new poll in Nevada showing that the governor, Governor Sandoval, would beat him by 10 points if the election were held today.
Right. He should have been out already, as you know. And
yes.
Don't
get me started.
I know.
Don't get me started.
Now, everybody's talking. You know, we've heard a lot of these so-called polling experts, the Cook Report and others, say it's more than likely Republicans are in place right now to take back the Senate. If they are able to do that, how would things be different in the final 2 years of President Obama? After all, he still could veto anything that comes down the pipe.
Yeah, he can. But look, there's only so many times that you can ask the Democrats to step up and vote to override a measure that is popular. And second of all, you can't veto everything. A lot of what we can do to constrain him is not vetoable or difficult to veto. You can't stop the Congress from conducting oversight and asking tough questions and revealing major problems inside the administration. And you can also put inside all of these spending bills measures that constrain the president's action and the president's ability to spend money. And it's sort of hard to continue for the president to say, well, you know what, I want the authority unilaterally to unilaterally suspend our immigration laws. Therefore, I'm vetoing the Department of the funding bill for Homeland Security. I mean, that's really, after a while, it gets hard and difficult, and members of your own party start saying to you, Mr. President, don't be doing that.
Yeah. I want you to, I was talking about this with Governor Huckabee last week, and he said if the Republicans do not win the Senate, he knows exactly who to blame. If Tom Cotton in Arkansas, he should be a layup, but yet he's trailing in most polls, he's not. He's listening to people in Washington and not to the people of Arkansas. Here's what he said, cut 19.
The reality is that they're going to make a lot of money whether their candidate wins or loses. They're not going to lose money. The day after the election, win or lose, they're going to be sunning themselves on a Caribbean beach. And the problem is that we have allowed these consultants to drive the candidates rather than let the candidates drive the campaign. And as a result, you have people who provide cookie-cutter ads, they provide cookie-cutter approaches, and they say, well, if this is what we did in Maryland, this is what we're going to do in Kansas. Well, I'm going to tell you, Maryland and Kansas are two very different states.
And he goes on. Does he have a point?
I think he does to some degree. I think consultants, this is one of the problems we have with the consulting class, is that they take something they did in one state and use it in another, and they seem to think there's one way to win a campaign rather than focusing first and foremost on who's our candidate, what are his or her strengths and weaknesses, what is it they want to make the campaign about, and how can we chart a path to victory using that basis. But I think there's a bigger problem here in that we do have these super PACs, and I'm involved in one, that some of them don't have adult supervision, and people get paid vast sums of money. In the super PAC I'm involved with, American Crossroads, we have a board of directors that hires the staff. We don't do the work ourselves. We go out and find the best person to do the work. And then the consultants who are doing the internet advertising or the mail or whatever get paid a modest fee, a fraction of what they normally get. And we're involved, and we have a lot of volunteers involved. I'm a volunteer. I help raise money and serve as a senior advisor, and I'm a volunteer. I don't even take my expenses. I fly around out of my own pocket and make there are so many generous donors out there who feel burned by the practices of modern American politics in which these consultants have got their, second, third vacation homes. And he's right. Governor Huckabee's right. A lot of them are going to be, laughing their way to the bank and spending their time on a warm beach after the election, win or lose.
This tape emerged on September 10th, 2001. Bill Clinton in Australia talking about bin Laden. I want you to listen.
And I'm just saying, if I were Osama bin Laden, he's a very smart guy. I spent a lot of time thinking about him. And I nearly got him once. I nearly got him. And I could have killed him, but I would have had to destroy a little town called Kandahar in Afghanistan and kill 300 innocent women and children. And then I would have been no better than him. And so I didn't do it.
Well, the next day we get hit on 9/11. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, how many eyes were there in there? Last time I checked, the President of the United States does not, man up and throw a M14 over his shoulder and jump on a helicopter. This is what was interesting to me was this is we've previously known about the attempt to get bin Laden in Sudan where they blew up the
aspirin.
The drug plant, which was really a front for Osama bin Laden and perhaps chemical weapons. We also knew about the hunting camp in northeast Afghanistan, where in 1999 an attack was called off because there were a bunch of people from the United Arab Emirates there, and they were afraid of killing them. This Kandahar episode has not surfaced that I'm aware of previously, and so I don't know the details of it. We haven't been told anything except what President Clinton said, which was, first of all, our precision weapons would not blow up a town of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And it strikes me that we just don't know the details. I don't know.
Well, how often did you guys talk about what could have been and what was left in your lap when you took over? People like to drill down on what happened in August when you got that threat assessment that said Bin Laden determined to attack in our homeland. And you can't do that without saying, why didn't we get him earlier?
Well, you know, maybe there's probably some discussion of that, but I'll tell you this. President Bush was a man who looked forward, not backwards. He wasn't a man who said, my object here is to condemn and blame the people.
Oh, I know. That's why they're friends today, right?
Well, his object was, what do we need to do? It's like, you know, that August threat assessment. You know, the thing that was just so exasperating about it was, first of all, we knew that, and second of all, the information did not point to any actionable event. I mean, you know, if they'd said, you know, and we think it's going here, or we picked up this piece of information, it could be going there, then that was a problem in dealing with a lot of al-Qaeda, because, you know, look, the decisions made by presidents tend to reverberate down the decades, and the decisions made by the Congress in the 1970s to gut the human intelligence capability of the CIA reverberated down the decades through Bush 41, through Clinton, and to us, because it meant we had a lot more reliance on electronic communications, cell phones and email eventually, and less on people on the ground who could actually eyeball people like Bin Laden and say, here's where he is and here's what he's up to.
Well, finally, Carl, it came out this week that 43 is writing about 41. President Bush about President Bush. How do you feel about the son writing about the father? What could you tell us about the approach he's taking?
Well, he began a couple of years ago, very quietly working on this. It was you could just tell how passionate he was about this as he worked. He was very much below the radar on this. People just didn't know that he was doing it. But he was preparing this book, and I think he didn't know exactly when it would come to fruition or how, but it's a wonderful, you know, decision points, which I don't care whether you like Bush or you don't like Bush. If you're interested in America today and you want to understand the presidency, it is a book well worth reading because it is so honest and so revealing and so, you know, pulls back the curtain on how a president makes decisions. It's a wonderful book. I'm thrilled that it has sold more decision points, has sold more copies than any other presidential memoir in history, which I think is terrific for him.
Right.
And this new book is going to be, you know, I started out as a young man working at the age of 22 for George H.W. Bush, who was then the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And it was through him, through that work, that I met his then young son, who was at Harvard Business School. And so I got to tell you, I'm so thrilled that the son has written about the father, and it is going to be, you know, an exceptional book. It's going to be a wonderful story of unconditional love and of a great, great man. I mean, a man who enlisted at the age of 17 in the United States Navy and became the youngest fighter pilot in World War II, a man who struck out on his own to go to the West, who left the comfort of New York and Connecticut in order to become an oil field salesman in Texas, and who built a wonderful company and a wonderful life and created with his wife an incredible family. And this is going to be a terrific book.
I just can't give for his perspective from what it was like to lose that second election to his dad's reaction when he became governor. It's going to be a great perspective. Was it the President Bush 43's idea?
Yeah. He saw these other people who were talking about writing books about his dad, and his attitude was, okay, fine, but, you know, they're going to be digging in some dusty archive trying to get a nugget of insight about his dad. And he said, I've had a unique vantage point from which to watch. And so it's going to be an extra. Think about this. Think if John Quincy Adams had written a book about his father. Think about if Franklin Roosevelt had written about his cousin, though they weren't as close. I mean, it's just an incredible story that, I mean, it's a unique story. Two men who've been president, and the son is writing about his father, and
from an
incredible viewpoint.
In both their lifetimes. Carl, it's always great, always educational. Now your mission is to have a great weekend.
And yours too, my friend.
Thank you.